had one of the worst experiences of my life. Trying Bikram yoga, that's no exaggeration. Trying Bikram yoga with Killer one time in Castle Troy. So I remember literally being delirious for the next hour. So all the Killer and me could do was, we moved from between lying on our back to lying on our side to lying on our front, and that was literally it. So all these people who were kind of seasoned Bikram yogis were doing all these ridiculously kind of complicated moves, and I remember for the first 15 minutes of that hour, say, we'd be kind of lying on our sides, literally looking at each other, genuinely worried, going like, I don't know if I'm gonna last here. And she'd come over and say, no, that's not it, that's not the move. And I remember us having to look at her and go, no, we can't do that. we'll just stay like this. Hello everyone, and welcome to week 5 of the Duncan & Duncan podcast. I'm your host Duncan Casey, joined as always by the delightful and ever smiling Duncan Williams. Duncan, how are you?
Very good, how are you?
Very well, very well. Looking forward to having a chat with our old teammate John Andrus.
Very excited by it, yeah.
He wouldn't be a household name in Irish rugby, but he had a fantastic playing career, predominantly in England, and after a brief stint at Munster and Connacht, it must be said, he has crossed over to the dark side and entered the murky world of being a sports agent, and more specifically rugby agent. So I think it's an area that people know very little about, so it should be a good, insightful chat.
Yeah,
we'll see. We mightn't use it at all if it's very bad. Anyway, you had a busy weekend. You played on Friday and Saturday, which not too many people in their mid-30s, nearing towards their mid-30s,
early,
are doing.
Early 30s.
Early to mid.
Yeah, played for Cannes on Friday night against UCC, local derby.
Yeah, I love the Friday night lights games. That's probably out of all the IL stuff, that's what I miss the most. Is there a big crowd there?
I liked it when I didn't actually have to do a proper day's work beforehand. It's a hard slog after doing a proper day's work, but there was actually a big crowd, considering the weather was absolutely horrendous.
Was it storm weather? Yeah, I suppose.
I was actually only saying, I don't think I've actually played a game in dry conditions since I retired, or since the final last year. Even in Bermuda, thunderstorms, like, it was there. Can't catch a break here. But it was fairly shocking, right, chat. Howling wind, rain.
They're any closer than you would have liked?
They actually got a push over try there in the second half that kind of brought them back within touching distance.
I come back embarrassed.
We were hard done for the scrum to happen, but they deserved to push or the penalty try off the scrum. But in the lead up to the scrum, they had a knock on. A guy picked it up from offside. We poached it, and the ref blew it up because we had an injury and said scrum to UCC. We were like, how is that possible?
You've gotten the rub of the green from the ref's point of view enough times over the years. You can't complain too much.
It was
a week or two before I moved back from Dublin to Limerick. That was the time Shannon got fined 25 grand for following the ref into the dressing room and abusing him. Were you playing that day?
Yeah.
Was a penalty? They gave you a penalty?
I gave a penalty last kick of the game, and right in front of the post.
But it was about 8 minutes into injury time.
But anyway, Scott DC stood up to take the kick. The penalty was only given about 7 metres from the try line, I'd say. But he didn't want to take it out any further because the weather was so shite. And he literally nearly put it under the bar. but yeah, we won, so their crowd weren't happy and followed the ref into the dressing room, and there was all sorts of commotion.
No, I remember reading about it and thinking, this is the club for me. I'll be perfectly at home here.
That's it.
So was there a big crowd at it?
Yeah, at the UCC game there was, yeah. As I said, the weather wasn't exactly conducive to running rugby, so it was good to see a good crowd there turn up and brave the misery.
The Friday Night Lights games are kind of one of the few sets of games that still attract a consistently good crowd throughout the season, I think, or particularly when around about 8-9 years ago when I started playing with Shannon first, games against Gary Owen or Munsters or Bowes when we were all in the same division, you'd get about 3,000 people at it, which is significant enough. I know when you talk to the old timers, they'd have you believe that there was 25,000 people at Temple Hill or Tomcliffe Park or wherever every week, but I don't think it was quite like that. So no, it's good to hear that people are still turning out. I was at the Shannon Nace game myself on Saturday afternoon. I actually went to my first pre-match meal.
What did you do at the pre-match meal?
I was guest of honour.
Prawn sandwich
on behalf of on behalf of, or I guess the honour on behalf of the Shannon committee. So I was at the president's table, I was at the top table, but it's actually great. Like, I mean, think about it, it's 10 quid to pay in to watch an AIL game. So the pre-match was 25, your match ticket is included. Lovely bacon and cabbage, apple pie and ice cream afterwards, and a coffee. For an extra 15 quid, it's not bad. I'm a seasoned user of the various carveries in Limerick City, and you wouldn't get a bacon and cabbage for much less than 12 quid.
You're always the good man for a recommendation of a good valued carvery.
So I'd recommend it to people if they are turning up to a game, have a look at the pre-match. Remember, I know the lads, and I'm sure there's a little bit of exaggeration, but they would say that back in the boom, say, they would have pre-matches in Shannon and Thomond with 150, 200 people at it. I think it's still quite like that in Dublin. From what I hear, places like Lansdowne and that, they'd have multiple tables filled.
Yeah, it used to be like that in Connazel, I remember. When we were under like 10s and 12s, we used to do the ball boys for the matches, so you'd be up there after training, you'd just stay up there all Saturday, and the crowds inside having the food and stuff, and then you're in selling raffle tickets after the game to try and make a bit of money for the club, and it's just, you could barely move inside there. Like, I could never get rid of mine, so I'd always give them to Billy Holland. He'd go in and flog everyone's tickets, so it was great.
Anyway, my stand-up moment of the game was to see our old colleague Sean McCarthy.
Was he back?
Yeah. He spent a year in Rome playing for the police academy team. Bizarrely enough, so he spent a year in Rome. He said he loved it, but he had a girlfriend back in Ireland and was kind of keen to move home. And
you always had a soft spot for Shawnee.
I do, yeah. No, I get on great with him. He's a great fella. Probably a combination of bad luck.
Your relationship is mainly you just slagging him, though, isn't it?
Yeah. I think there's a large enough number of my relationships with people, positive relationships with people, that are centred around me slagging them. I think Sherry, the same concept with Sherry. Isn't that how we grew close in the first place? Me just abusing you.
Yeah, my hairline. I wore you down. Got you in the door, didn't it?
But he made a great break. Handed off a 13, I think. Made a line break, handed off another, and then chipped kind of one of those infield kicks that you would have seen JPR Williams kind of pulling off routinely back in the day. And I can't remember who it was. I think it might have been Pat Ryan, actually, who we were talking about earlier, who had a great campaign with the Irish clubs recently. Picked it up and they finished it off. So I've seen Shawnee set up a number of tries with crossfield kicks.
I was about to say, he pulled off one of the greatest kicks I've ever seen in my life when we were playing that B&I Cup over in Yorkshire, Carnegie. He was literally on the left touchline, I'd say a yard off the touchline, and he hit it like a banana off the outside of his foot. 50, 60 metres, curled it perfectly, trickled into touch, just kind of short of their line. It wasn't like he didn't mean to do it, which was just phenomenal. I was standing right behind him, I was like, holy shit. You could actually hear me like on the video and everything, like, it was a ridiculous kick.
Oh yeah, well, he played minor football for Kerry, so he has plenty of ability. I think he does, he used to line out the odd time for Curro. I'm not sure if he still does, but there's an excellent athlete.
There's a lash of 3 points after him.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Down in Cunuffs, I think that's the name of the pub down there. But anyway, moving on from AIL, tell us about your Saturday. You played in the Legends game.
Yeah, so early start. Got picked up by Anthony Horgan and Dennis Fogarty at 6:15 for a 7:30 flight to London Heathrow. So we got there and picked up, brought to the Lensbury Hotel, dropped the bags, went for a bit of breakfast, and then back to the hotel. So we were getting picked up at 2 to go to the ground we were playing in, the Stoop. Kickoff wasn't 5:30, so we didn't know what we were doing, getting picked up, going to the ground. They were like, there's a big jersey signing. We went in and signed 5 jerseys. We're like, really, did this need us to be here for 3.5 hours? But
so what's the concept of a Legends game? Like, I know,
so it was to raise money for Tom Smith this year. Obviously he was diagnosed with bowel cancer or stomach cancer or something along those lines, and he's terminally sick, so it was okay. From that point of view, it's great to be involved and raise money for that. I think the original one was Axel a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Or not the original, but they did one for him as well. So it's a great occasion. To be fair, there's a big crowd there as well, good turnout, some big names from the, it was meant to be Irish Legends against English Legends. It was more just English Legends against washed up Irish fellas.
What kind of names are we talking?
For England or for Ireland?
Well, for both, yeah.
So Gordon Darcy's playing for us, actually. Chris Henry, two Scottish lads, Kelly Brown and Ali Hogg.
All right, very good.
Yeah, two very nice lads, actually. Scott Deasy was playing.
Oh, yeah.
So we're reeling
a true Irish legend.
Yeah, reeling in the years, myself and Scotty. So another trophy to to get a photo taken with the two of us. There was Dara Fanning was there, Stephen Kuehl, Shane Byrne.
Shane Byrne's kind of... Gallagher
pulled out with a back spasm.
Was he meant to play, was he?
He was meant to come over anyway. I don't know if it was just for the social outing or what.
I wonder how many times he's pulled out with a back spasm and again for those
apparently
things.
He walked out and Bob's kicked off and he walked off last year.
And what about the English lads?
Yeah, there's a few World Cup winners, like, to be fair. They had Lewis Moody, Mike Tindall, Ben Cohen, Jason Leonard.
I remember, how is it as a game? Do people take it seriously? Are people there to kind of predominantly enjoy themselves or...
Does I was kind of dreading that it was going to be like Bermuda because I thought going to Bermuda was going to be an absolute jolly, but the rugby was actually quite hard. And then
I remember Flash saying
there was a few hits going on in this. Like,
was there?
Like Nick Easter got a bit tetchy. Himself and Foggs had a bit of a run in. Dennis Fogarty. But there was this fella, actually. Looked 50. Do you remember Mickey Rourke? That's what you remind me of.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely battered. And he was killing lads. I don't know where he was getting the energy from. He was in everything. He was nailing lads and tackles, poaching, bashing fellas, everything. Rory Jenkins, I think, was his name. He was wearing two scrum caps. And
Why?
Face battered off him. I don't know what the story behind that was. But
if there's a sign that there's a fella's a mad bastard, it's something like wearing two scrum caps when you're playing a game.
Yeah, but no, we won anyway. So it was, it was a good occasion. As I said, it was good to get over there and be involved in something that helps raise money for things like that. So it was a good crack.
Who was kind of in good nick, who looked like they could still have been playing professionally, and who had kind of let themselves go physically, but just looked a bit old and haggard?
Who was in good nick now from our side? Kelly Brown, he's still in good nick.
So he only finished 2 years ago?
18 months, I think he said.
Yeah. So.
Gordon Darcy looked relatively in good nick.
Oh, the Pilates.
Yeah.
Really, Pilates 3 times a day.
That's a Driscoll, no?
No, it's Gordon Darcy's wife, and he and his wife have the Pilates studio.
Oh, do they?
In Dublin, yeah.
So
I always wondered, there must be a massive gulf in, like, say a guy like Kelly Brown or Dylan Armitage or yourself who literally just stopped playing versus, say, if Golliff had played, like, when they got him stopped playing.
Liam Tolan was playing, like, he would probably be, or Paddy Johns is playing, actually.
Was he?
Well, he must be nearly 60.
Yeah, a tough guy, all the same. I'm sure he was well able to hold his own. I remember Flad telling a story about the first time he played in one of them, and he said he was kind of going out thinking...
Flad was taking it handy, right?
This is what he said anyway. But he said he was on the ground... Or sorry, Martin Johnson was on the ground, and he kind of went down to give him a hand to pull him up, and he slapped it away. And he said he just saw red and was just running around trying to kill people for the rest of the game, basically. But no, I wouldn't be in the right condition to play a Legends game now, but it sounds like a school crack. I'm sure
Tom May, for England, he seems to be in good nick. Lewis Moody looks pretty fit. Yeah, Nick Easter's still pretty much the same shape as he was when he was playing.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether that's deemed to be good or bad. He obviously had a good engine on him.
I assume you had a decent feed of pints afterwards as well.
Yeah, so I was into the clubhouse for food and pints after, and then stayed there for a couple of hours and then back to some pub around the corner from there.
It's not a bad little circuit, to be honest. You seem to have kind of wormed your way into it.
Yeah.
Tony Buckley was playing with the Shannon Thirds for years, just specifically to stay fit for the Bermuda trip.
Yeah.
He still togs out the odd time, which I think is a bit unfair. For anyone that's playing Thirds rugby on a casual basis, to be lining out against Mushy.
No, it's a good, it's good things to be involved in. I suppose kind of get to meeting a few lads as well that you mightn't see for months or years on without seeing them. So it's good to get that opportunity to get together and have a few pints. Like, I suppose I haven't seen Scott DC for a good while now. I played against Lansdowne earlier in the season. He was coaching. We had a bit of a chat, like, but get to have a few drinks with him is, you don't really get that opportunity very often, so it's good to meet up with those kind of lads that you wouldn't see too often anymore.
Of course, and everyone being in a similar enough boat as well.
Yeah. Like, no one's taking themselves too seriously. Like, I played, Chris Henry was there, I played schoolboys with him, and probably haven't really seen him, met him once or twice after matches, like, just chatting after games, but to sit down and have a proper chat with him after all these years is, you know, it's quite enjoyable.
Hello. We've got another week to get back on the horse, you know, and take that horse to the water. And you can ask that horse, you can say, hey, horsey, do you want to have a drink or do you want to swim? Yeah, and it's up to that horse to then realise what he wants to do in his life. And that horse at the moment wants to go out on Saturday. He wants to clippity-clop all the way to the stoop. He wants to say hello to those fans.
The next is something that's in the news at the moment. We kind of alluded to it last week when we were talking about Barry White from the Business Post writing about like investment from CVC, who are a private equity group who have been kind of buying up substantial shares of various competitions in the last few years, kind of with a view to reshaping rugby kind of away from its current segregation in terms of hemispheres and making it one global calendar and one global international league and one global club league. And they were kind of...
Does that global club league go whoever wins their Pro 14 and whatever goes into this thing? Or is it just going to be one global league, that's it?
I don't know, to be honest. It's very loose because it's not materialising yet, but I'm sure they have a plan in their heads. But, like, I mean, it wouldn't be encouraging because...
How many teams are going to be then in the league?
Oh, yeah, well, exactly. But this is it. But, like, say, for example, I think it's going to... Their version of what it was going to be at international level was going to be the Nations Championship, the thing that has basically had to be abandoned because there was such uproar about it. So, I'm just reading an article here from the Financial Times by Murad Ahmed, who's kind of one of their sports journalists, and they've invested £300 million to acquire 14% in the Six Nations, £120 million in the Pro 14, and that would take their overall investment in various competitions to £600 million over the last 2 years. They won 27% of Premiership Rugby, for example. So it's very much moving towards that global brand with kind of global television rights and that kind of thing. So they're obviously doing it because they believe that there's money to be made in it, but it raises a lot of concerns. I mean, my biggest kind of concern would be that invariably a lot of teams are going to be excluded who aren't at the top level and who can't compete in that global league. And I don't know if it's an accurate thing, but I remember, like, League of Ireland, for example, before the time of television being readily accessible for a lot of people, like, there would genuinely be 15,000, 20,000, 25,000 people at games down at Flower Lodge, as it was known at the time, to see Cork Cubs, Cork Athletic, whatever. There was massive interest in the game, and then when people could readily watch Premiership, that completely depleted. And I mean, attendances are quite stagnant in the League of Ireland, and it's a massive concern.
With the AIL, if you look at it, I remember I was at a Munster Senior Cup final between Sundaysville and Young Munster in Musgrave Park. It must have been 92 or 3 or something. There was like 9,500 people at it. But like now there's so many matches on TV that people are happy just to stay at home watching TV as opposed to obviously the weather isn't great as well, which doesn't help. So
no, you're dead right, though.
Bigger names aren't playing, but
I went to watch Conn and Munsters in Musgrave Park, I'd say it was 2 years ago, I'd say, maybe 3, with my dad. And I remember we parked in an estate nearby, and I remember getting out of the car going, did we have the time wrong? Because there was no noise coming from the stadium at all. We went in and there was about 800 people at it, which, I mean, like, you would have thought that something like a Munster Senior Cup would have retained an element of the appeal.
But even when we were at that game at the weekend, the Legends game, actually, Stephen Keogh, who is the biggest Shannon head that ever existed, claims he never lost a game against Conn. It's his go-to story whenever a rugby comes up. But anyway, he was like saying that he remembered there used to be marquees on the side pitch in Conn, like choppers landing and people getting out and everything. Like,
is that right?
Yeah, thousands of people at it. Like, so, like, to look at it compared to from now to then, it's a bit mad. Like,
yeah, it is. But I mean, I can see that being replicated. I mean, if you look at attendances in the Pro 14 as is, I think it was like, I think the expansion to 14 from 12 has kind of diluted the appeal of it already. Mm-hmm. The split into conferences I don't think is good either. I mean, attendances are very poor kind of on a consistent basis around it. Certain teams are better than others. Certain fixtures are better than others, obviously. But I mean, a lot of teams are going to be forgotten if it moves away from the current format. I mean, like, obviously, everyone wants to see the best teams in the world going at each other, but I just don't know how practical it is. I mean, the inclusion of South African teams, with the exception of maybe a cool trip for the players. Were you on one of those trips?
I was last year, yeah. It was only it wasn't a 2-weeker, it was only the 1 week, played the Cheetahs, so we were in Johannesburg for most of the week and then up to Bloemfontein to play the match.
Did they didn't double up the fixtures then, did they?
No, so you only played in...
Oh, right, because they're in the other conference.
Yeah.
I see.
So 1 year, it's 2 weeks, next year it's 1 week, so... I got injured the previous year for the 2 week one.
I didn't get injured. I just wasn't going to figure. Thankfully, I was gone to Grenoble at that stage anyway. But I remember
myself, Mike Sherry, and Dez with the three lads stuck at home.
You were injured, but the lads had to train with the academy.
Oh yeah, I was training with the academy as well because I was just back from the facial injury I got. But I think they were kind of alluded to that they might be flown out for the second week, so they'd come in from training to be refreshing the emails every 2 minutes. Nick beat to Daz every time. Did you get the email, Daz? Daz would check his phone, right, and get it out there.
What so, a cruel carrot to be dangling in front of him with probably no intention of ever bringing them.
That was it. Like, it was hilarious.
No, I was glad I was gone at that stage because obviously I was still in the Munster players group, and like they'd be putting in selfies of when they were about to drive down and train with all the 19-year-olds. I was thinking, God, I don't know if I could have handled that. I'd say I would have done a hamstring that week or something.
Yeah, and then the other lads over in South Africa in the WhatsApp group were like, lads are going out for dinner there and a glass of wine. Like,
like a 400-gram steak and some local wine. But yeah, other than that, like I don't really see like I don't think it's had a hugely positive impact on the league. I mean, it's split it. It's made it more complicated in general from the point of view of conferences. And like, has it really been much of a boon for attendances and interest? I don't think so.
But are they saying, is this what's driving, they're buying into the Six Nations and this is what's driving the rumour of South Africa coming up, is it?
I think South Africa are refusing to comment on that, but...
Which is always... Razzie refusing to comment about it. I'm going back. Are you moving back to Africa? No comment.
But they're obviously... They're spreading their wealth into... Or they're spreading their wealth into enough pots to hopefully have enough control over the global game. Yeah. And I mean, like, I was listening yesterday to talk about there being... like a single global golf league going forward and there's a lot of Saudi Arabian money behind that, and like you can see the appeal of it in one sense in that you want to see the best players or best of any the best teams, best individuals in any sport going at each other on a regular basis, but you inevitably will ruin all the culture and tradition that other competitions have, you know. So
didn't McIlroy come out and say he's definitely not going to take part in it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I think Tiger Woods said the same because like it'd just be very demanding. So there'd be a minimum number of tournaments you have to turn up to, but they'd be kind of all over the world, if you get me. So I know there's certain players that float between the two at the moment, but it would kind of eliminate that. What changes do you think there could kind of feasibly be to make the game a bit more global at the moment? Something like Japan or South Africa coming into the Six Nations?
Yeah, I don't know. Would Japan go to the training or the Rugby Championship for the Six Nations if they were to go to one? What would be the... I think they need to be in something anyway. Obviously, they showed in the World Cup how, you know, they're a breath of fresh air the way they try and play the game, and that they can compete at a top level. So I think you saw Argentina, like they struggled for years and then they came into that and they obviously came on another bit more, started playing a good brand of rugby. You saw what being involved in the Rugby Championship did for them. So yeah, I don't know, like, where Japan, I think, deserve to be in some,
they do definitely,
but I just don't know which one would it be. Probably be the Southern Hemisphere one realistically, would it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not, it's like it is a lot closer than, say, traveling to travel, or like it's a lot closer for an Irish team, for example, to travel to Japan than it would be to travel to New Zealand or something like that. Like, it wouldn't be beyond the realms of possibility, I don't think. Based on their track record in the previous World Cup cycle against tier one nations, they probably wouldn't have merited it. I think they only had one victory over Tier 1 team between the two World Cups, but obviously they took massive scalps against Scotland and Ireland, so they're full value to be involved in some regular competitive competition there, particularly given how popular it is in the aftermath of the World Cup. I think I was saying to you just before we started recording that one game at the weekend, which finished, I think, 59-0 or something like that, or 57-0, there were 23,000 people there to watch it. So there's obviously an appetite there. And I mean, speaking from CVC's point of view, if they're talking about emerging markets in kind of affluent economies, I mean, that would be quite an obvious one for...
Especially after the World Cup being such a hit there, and obviously they did so well that the public have a high interest in it now as well, so it definitely would make sense.
Absolutely, there must be a huge appetite for rugby there going forward, and the money is there already. They're attracting a lot of high quality players already, so it's almost a ready made model for them. But yeah, I think the cons of this kind of development outweigh the pros. It just seems to be part of an overall move towards profiteering in sport rather than. And I don't want to sound like too much of a purist. Like, obviously, sport needs private investment and it needs to be profitable for the people that are investing. But I think if you do something as drastic as this, then in entire sections of leagues are going to be wiped out. And
you want to quote Dentuhi and say rugby's rotten to the core.
But he actually didn't elaborate on what it was. because Larry our fantastic producer who's the magician behind the scenes, he said it to me earlier and I was kind of waiting for the punchline more or less, and there was nothing. It was just like, it's rotten to the core. It's not like it used to be.
I made a great living off it, but I played it down underage. He's a nice lad.
Oh, yeah, no, I've met him before, and a great player as well. Had a great
sounds
career.
Like a nasty injury, to be fair.
Yeah, it does. Anything around, it was a hand, wasn't it?
The nerve in his arm, basically. He can't move his fingers into it, I don't think.
So, rotten to the core, and I'm not entirely sure. But I would probably have to ask him what he meant by it, to be honest, before making an opinion.
Hard hitting, sometimes brutal. Brilliant at the breakdown, and never afraid to tackle the big names. Read Ronan O'Gara, Simon Lewis, and me, Donal Lenehan, in the Irish Examiner for the best insights and analysis on all the key matches throughout the Six Nations Championship. The 2020 Six Nations in the Irish Examiner. We've got every position covered.
Well, moving on from that, obviously a predominantly negative weekend for the Irish teams over the last few days.
Yeah.
The women shipping a heavy defeat, the 20s getting an excellent win, but the men, I suppose, the standout, a very disappointing result for them. The two tries, I suppose, we go into, I mean, everything's going to be analysed to death anyway, but just something that you might be able to shed a bit of light on. Can you explain what's going on in the backfield, the way that England are able to attack the space as well as they have? Because it was almost a carbon copy of the way they approached the game 12 months ago when they really took Ireland apart with a really offensive tactical kicking game. So can you shed a bit of light on why that space is there and if it should be there?
Obviously, Andy Farrell worked with England and Saracens for a number of years, so obviously those lads would know his defensive system in and out and where those gaps and maybe opportunities would arise. So the way defence is kind of going at the moment is either 13-2, so 13 in the front line, 2 in the back line, or nearly 14-1 as you get closer to your line. So my understanding is that from an early Irish point of view, the 15 would be in behind the ball, so he'll be basically in behind the ruck, however deep it is, however deep he is off the line, and then the wingers are up flat, but they're reading body language, so as soon as the 10 shapes the kick, they're dropping to catch that on the full without letting it bounce. I only looked at this kind of just there before we came in, and it looks like Larmer maybe got a bit further over than he was in the centrally positioned. He was maybe gone a bit further past the ruck, and then obviously they were going from right to left, and Ben Young's bounced back to the right, so maybe the winger wasn't expecting him to put that grubber in there like that, so maybe he didn't read the body language. Maybe he was a bit slow to react, and that gave, I suppose, Sexton did react it, but obviously the hop of the ball kind of cut him off.
It's one of those things. I remember it was actually the week before the game against Racing, when Axel passed away, we lost to Leinster the week before. And remember Tyler fumbled a ball over the line, and they scored a try off it. And I remember Razzie saying in the review, just saying, like, you just have to laugh at these things. I mean, like, it's not even a lapse in concentration. It's just one of those things that will happen from time to time. So, I mean, you the can't really read too far into it. They seem to have it covered more or less, just the bounce of the ball is literally it.
That's the one thing that people can underrated Rob Kearney for. His backfield cover was always ridiculous. I remember we were going playing Leinster a few times. We tried these set-up plays where we'd do a kick and where the space would be like, but he, every time, always caught it on the full, never let it hop or anything. And like, I think, obviously, he played for Ireland for 10 years, so obviously he developed that understanding of the game over those years. And obviously Larmer's relatively new to international rugby in the larger scheme of things, and maybe, as I said, just was caught that yard or two out of position, just from, as I said, he's played a lot on the wing as well, so maybe he's not 100% sure of it, but you know, still kind of learning the game. And
it was brilliantly executed, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was pre-call.
Obviously, you could tell by the
I don't know, was that a set play pre-call, but definitely they obviously had it in their minds of thinking that as a quick change of direction and putting that ball in behind maybe might catch them out.
It looked like it, just the way that they were steaming onto it and were ready to go at it. It looked like it had been pre-called.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you have to take your hat off to that kind of thing, really. The second one, probably, like the second one, I reckon Stockdale catches that.
I think he accelerates.
He obviously gets caught in two minds. But that's one that... Okay, the kick went in behind. It's easy to probably look at the two through the same lens, but I think on an ordinary day, Stockdale or whoever's chasing it catches that in the full and it's a 22 dropout.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was just not too casual, but just maybe kind of leaving it to chance as opposed to just, I don't know why he didn't just take it and get blown out over the dead ball. I mean, what's still a 22 dropout, so...
Were excellent, though. One of the WhatsApp groups I'm in... Someone put in the England team during the week and people were like, what do you think of this? And I said, oh, it's not a bad selection for Ireland now. They're kind of having issues with picking players out of position. So I say, Courtney Laws isn't really a six.
Yeah.
Tom Curry isn't really an eight. And Jonathan Joseph isn't a winger. Of course, Courtney Laws got man of the match. Jonathan Joseph could have been man of the match if Laws hadn't played so well.
Yeah.
He didn't put a foot wrong all day. It was just brilliant. And Tom Curry, obviously very solid at eight. So I read that wrong.
Yeah. The thing with a few of those English lads in that pack, so obviously the Saracens lads we would have played over the last couple of years, but the amount of pressure they actually put on your defensive breakdown as you're trying to exit, it's ridiculous. Like George Cruz and Atoja are two of the hardest people to play against in terms of trying to exit from a box kick. They literally make it an absolute shit fight. So they're pulling lads in, trying to get the ball for the ball to be out. They're pulling, dragging, like they'll be on the ground, they're still trying to pull lads out. Their motto is, or their mentality is that if I'm affecting this, I'm going to try and take two or three lads down with me and just make it an absolute shit fight for nine. And then even after that, then they're putting so much pressure on the actual kick as well, trying to charge it down. Like, I told you I get one or two the last day. I think he charged it.
He did, definitely.
One. But,
he's a constant nuisance.
Every game he plays, if you notice, he gets like a hand to a couple of kicks. He charges one down flush most of the time as well. And George Cruz is very good at it. I remember the couple of times I played against Saracens, it was... They're screaming at you as well. Is that ball out, ref? Is that out? He's going to kick. Left foot, whatever. But it's like a complete pressure game and they're just waiting for that one time for you to crack. Obviously, Murray's kicks were affected a few times. That put England straight on the front foot again and just kept the pressure on Ireland. And I think finally, you know, the pressure told and they managed to get those chinks.
I remember JJ explaining it to me that... It comes directly from Saracens, that kind of role, and I think Saracens have three guys assigned in their pack. I think it's Atoje, Cruz and Vincent Cock, whose job is to just go around and make shit of breakdowns all day. They literally just go around and they have a license to attack because they're so confident in the people around them to not need 14 people or 13 people in the front line. They just go around and cause havoc at rooks, and it's one of those things. I remember Paulie's often quoted as saying, like, be the best at the things that require no talent, and like that doesn't require any talent at all.
But the beauty of that is that they're like, they're doing their best to affect it and get a charge on. But if people think, oh, they didn't actually get the charge on, but they affect the kick so much that, like, you're trying to clear it straight at the touch, it doesn't go out on the full. They're just running straight back at you again and the pressure is on again. So it's like, literally, if they get a charge down, all well and good, but if they affect the kick and make you kick it too long, not kick it out in the full, too short, you know, they're just ridiculous at it.
It's those things that aren't really appreciated by anyone outside of the playing group, isn't it?
People just think Murray had a bad kick or whatever, but the amount of pressure he's under there is ridiculous.
And yeah, just on that... Like I told you, is obviously part of his remit is to make life miserable for players. CJ got caught up in a couple of incidents and like being held kind of in around the ruck. I know his jersey got ripped off him at one stage, but there's very little protection for players that are caught in that position. Like if you're holding someone in, you're breaking the law there. Particularly, like, I mean, I told you, I was holding the two of them in for about 15-20 seconds afterwards. But you're not entitled to lash out and actually defend yourself. So it's a very difficult position to find yourself in. And it's completely biased in favour of the person who's breaking the law initially. So, like, I remember seeing Cian Healy holding Matuwalu in playing against Glasgow a few years ago. And now Matuwalu hit him an open hand in the face, which you can't do. But, like it was a penalty and yellow card or a red card maybe from Adewalu, and just no sanction for Healy, even though he was the one that started the whole thing.
We're always told if you're going to hit, make sure it's an open hand.
An open hand, but like a push. Not in the really.
Hit, yeah. But like, to be, I thought CJ dealt with it fairly well. Like, he was trying to draw the ref's attention to it. Farrell wasn't letting go of him. He didn't hit him in the face, he was hitting him in the chest, in the ribs or whatever. And yeah. I thought the TMO, it was fair. You could hear him saying, oh, there's nothing in it. He's hitting him with an open hand. Farrell's totally in the wrong or whatever. So, to be fair to CJ, I thought he like that could have been an easy instance where you lose your
Absolutely. Cool. That's
even
the
way he was trying
to
flick him off his leg was quite quite funny as well. To be fair, I thought he dealt with it quite well.
But it's just, it was funny seeing how
Farrell was incensed by the fact that he didn't get a penalty.
You can't punch me. Like, well, you're holding him in and you're refusing to let him go.
Yeah.
Remember the old trick, my old trick when you probably used to get away with it, I think most people's tricks was like, lift the leg that's being held, like make it look like you're trying to put it away, but actually be trying to get it down as hard as you can on top of him or on his hands.
Dropping the knee in his face.
Yeah, oh, well, yeah. But that's like, what else can you do to free yourself? That's why, like on another day, or say if CJ had hit him a bit harder or with more of a closed fist, that would have been penalty, potentially card for CJ, even though what's he supposed to do there? Yeah. So it's an area that needs clarification, because the refs just ignore it when they see it, even if it's blatantly obvious.
And they've gotten a bit better. It used to be ridiculous. Remember, Leinster always do the long rocking for their power plays that they were setting up, where the guy would go beyond the ruck and take out a few lads and hold them. They're actually getting a bit better at that, but I know what you mean. They're still fellas on the ground getting away with holding on to lads.
Yeah. It's like I was saying, like, it's very it's kind of a no-win situation for the player that's being restrained, which Farrell's reaction was quite funny.
Well, I told you his motto there when he had the two lads is that he was out of the game, so his remit there was to take out as many Irish lads as he could to keep them out of the game. So he actually had three of them. Toner managed to snake out of it before the scuffle started, so he had Pete and CJ, and Toner managed to get his way out of it. But like, that's just typical him. He was going hell for leather at that breakdown, trying to affect the exit. Then he was out of the game, so he's like, I'm just going to try and keep as many Irish players out of the next phase of play as possible. So,
well, it's best practice, really, from his point of view, from a forward's point of view. I mean, it's good coaching. Axel used to be a big fan of it. He said, if you're going to be out of the game, take someone with you, particularly your own Mulls. That's where it comes from predominantly. Our forwards coach in France was a big proponent of that. It's just be a nuisance.
The other one is when you're, you know, the 2-on-1 with the fullback, and he brings in the fullback and he passes. That fullback should always take out that fella no matter what if he's passes, just so he doesn't get a support line for a ball back inside.
Yeah,
Joey's there, so if he's throwing you into the tackle, make sure he goes on the ground as well, that he's not staying alive for an inside pass or whatever. So that was always another one we were told to do.
Yeah, let's take the man out. Make sure you hit him.
Because otherwise he's just going to get in support, and if some fella does manage to scurry across, he's there for the offload or whatever.
It was funny seeing how Henshaw blatantly took was it Johnny May out when he kicked up the wing there. It's like an NFL no shoulders, no arms, but he got away with it anyway. He probably had to do it to save a try, but anyway, moving on from that, to talk about the scrums, Ireland have been struggling a bit more at scrum time than they're probably used to in the last few years. And I think it shouldn't be underestimated, the last that Rory Best is at scrum time, he was a ridiculously destructive scrummager.
Yeah, he had a big reputation as a big scrummager. I think it's kind of one of those things that people always go, oh, he's good at the scrum, kind of don't really give it the time it deserves. But it just kind of shows, I suppose, since he has left it, what was really solid for the last couple of years.
Exactly.
Becoming a bit of a focal point for people talking after matches. So it's interesting to see how that'll develop.
That's right. And Herring is much taller than kind of your average hooker. He's a lot taller than me anyway.
You're not your average hooker.
It wouldn't be too difficult. But I think it's something that they might have overlooked. And again, I know we spoke about being surprised that Niall Scannell wasn't included in at least the greater squad initially because of his set piece. But I think that's something that they might have to look at. With Scan, you're always going to get excellent lineouts, and you're always going to get strong and destructive scrummaging. So I think it's something that they might have to relook now after this break. Ellis Genge caused a lot of damage, in particular when he came on, but Porter was struggling with him. Porter got caught high a couple of times, but for me, Ellis Genge is scrummaging very illegally quite frequently. He's like, it's kind of hard to articulate without being able to show people, but if, like, BJ Botha was great for having a short bind, and he'd get away with it most of the time. What I mean by having a short bind is, best practice and what the refs are told to look for is make sure that people have their arms more or less fully extended mm-hmm. where possible. And what BJ used to do was he'd bind just on the back of someone's shoulder and he'd pull his arm towards himself. So he was kind of using his arm almost as another point of contact to push off. And you get away with it far less now than you would have previously. But that's what Ellis Genge was doing. I know he walked them backwards over on the right-hand side in his first scrum of the day, and he got blown for it the second time. But I think the refs need to be on top of that a bit more. There's very little that Porter can do in that situation if he's following the rules and Genge is slipping his bind and essentially using his arm to push across into Porter's ribs. You kind of have to rely on your ref to protect you there, and that didn't really happen at the weekend.
Yeah, we were discussing earlier the stats around Porter's caps for Leinster, and he actually has quite a low percentage of them as a starting tight head in, especially, well, all the matches, but especially in the big European matches.
Yeah, I was surprised at this. I didn't realise this at all.
I think he's actually started like nearly the most games already this year over all the other years. Obviously, Tadhg Furlong's come back from the World Cup, has gotten a good break. So I just think it's interesting to see that he's, I think in the last three seasons so far, he's only started like 17 games.
Yeah, which is very
low.
For a man
with 60-odd caps, it's kind of, it's a bit strange, though, to say if you're not playing in those. I know he comes on, as you said, for 25-30 minutes in most European games, but to say that he's kind of coming into these big international games that haven't started many of the big European matches, you know, where you learn your trade, especially as a young fella, it's, you know, I think, obviously they're not going to drop Tadhg Furlong for him as well, but maybe he needs to be pushing kind of for those starts as opposed to getting just 20-25 minutes in those big games. It might stand to him.
Yeah, I think definitely. Well, a team like Leinster, who have the luxury of doing that, I mean, in their pool in Europe, there were a few enough games that they were actually in danger of losing. I mean, they put cricket scores on people routinely, and they did that last year as well. So I would like to see him getting 60 minutes rather than 20 or 30 from time to time. And even with Ireland as well, I'd like to see him get a start against Italy to freshen things up a little bit. He's an excellent player. Quite a cool fella as well. He's like just the tattoos and stuff like that. You don't really see that in Irish rugby. Really, you haven't traditionally anyway. He's kind of the first of that breed. I know he was in Blackrock with Conor Oliver and Jeremy Lachman, and they're all kind of cut from a similar enough cloth.
I hope for his sake he isn't.
But you know, he's only 23 years old, I think, and he will be an excellent player and a very important part of Ireland's plans going forward. So I don't think it's any harm that they're managing them. Yeah. I think Leinster traditionally managed people in that position really well. I remember playing against Tadhg when he was playing for Clontarf, when I was playing for Shannon, and even though he was playing Irish 20s, he was in the Leinster Academy, but for that first couple of years out of school, he was only allowed to play 20 minutes for Clontarf, usually at the end of games. And I actually remember having conversations with JJ, who was the same age as him, and saying, like, why aren't they letting this guy play? He needs to play. And they said, no, they're just really minding him. And I remember thinking it was a stupid idea at the time. Yeah. But obviously it seems to have paid off. And there's method to the madness. I know we'd be giving out at the same time that guys in academies aren't playing enough with their clubs. But I think in certain positions, potentially, there's method to minding
guys. Do you think if a guy for one of the other provinces is starting week in, week out, and in those European games and going well in the big European matches, that maybe they deserve a chance to be in the 23 and off there? Say, I don't know, Finlay Beelam, say, for example, he's playing with Connacht tight head and the scrum is going well all season, and he started to improve himself in those big games. Do you think he deserves a shot to be in the squad? Or,
oh, definitely.
Look at John Ryan and Archer. They've played I suppose Archer's probably played most of the European games this year, and he's done quite well. You know, the scrum has been pretty good for Munster, especially against Saracens and Racing, like two big scrummaging teams. I know there's more to it than scrummaging, but just from that point of view.
Well, absolutely. I always think where possible, or if it's reasonable, that a guy who's starting each week, particularly if a province is doing relatively well,
I know both of them to get out of the group stages now and stuff in Europe, but
yeah, but even if you take last year, for example, like there was never any question that, like, John was going to be the nail on second choice, or even this year when Archer was playing very well and playing more or less every week, that Archer was going to break into the squad and kind of thrust one of those people aside. So I would always prefer to see the Munster guy getting a nod.
I'm not saying they should, I'm just saying.
Oh, no, I know. Generally speaking, yeah. I do think with a team like Leinster, who are as good as they are, there's a bit more leeway there. But I would usually disagree with the idea of picking second choices at one club if there isn't a massive gap in standard between them and the others. So I think a lot of lads in Munster and Ulster in particular have been unlucky to miss out on that basis in recent years. But I think that it might be a bit different now under Andy Farrell. I know, like, it was no secret that Joe Schmidt had a much higher opinion of Leinster guys for the most part than he did of guys in the other provinces. Yeah. So
I think when the pressure came on, in particular, he'd always revert back to the fellas who performed from his time in Leinster and the opportunities they got in Ireland, which is understandable to an extent as well. But if at some point it comes where you got to just say, history is history, you know, need to give a few lads a shot. So
yeah, no, absolutely.
Now, hopefully in this next coming weeks now, there'll be a few more lads who get a go.
Yeah, absolutely. England seeming to be a bit of a kryptonite team for Ireland at the moment. Yeah. There doesn't seem to be anything that they can do. Did you have any kryptonites when you were playing, either individuals or
most
teams?
Most people probably just say rugby, but there was a few away trips that always Cardiff away, I think. Probably played there 7 or 8 times. I probably had one decent game. Treviso away was always a graveyard.
Yeah, it was a real bogey one, wasn't
it? As I said last week, it cost many a man a contract. Scarlets was always a tough one.
Yeah, I reckon Scarlets for me as well. Scarlets away, just a very
the
difficult
crowd
place
horrible,
to go.
Everything, it's just, you always get two Welsh touchies. You know, usually get Dudley Phillips, which we've discussed at length before. So yeah, Cardiff as well is always it's a hard place to go. It's a fast pitch, you know, the 4G, those two lads in the centre, Lilo and Halaholo, as we discussed before. When they get a bit of go forward and a bit of momentum, they're frightening.
For me, if it was more individuals, and actually to go back to my AIL days, anyone that kind of played AIL around a certain time period would remember Leo Ova, I think that's how you pronounce it.
Old rubber legs.
The big massive Samoan.
Sure, you'd hit him
eight.
And like his legs would go limp and he'd wriggle out of the tackle. You're just like, what the hell?
So he was a fixture in Belvedere. He was there for quite a few years, wasn't he? He was kind of part of the furniture up there.
He had Leinster contract for a while.
He did, yeah.
Did he go to Treviso then?
Zebra, I think. Eroni, was it? As it was at the time, maybe. It was the crowd before Zebra.
Yeah.
But he definitely played in Italy, and I think he played in Newcastle for a little bit as well.
Yeah.
But, I mean, just your stereotypical enormous Polynesian back row, 125, 130 kilos.
He destroyed us in the AIL final that year. Con played Belvedere. We had an unbelievable team. We had, like, numerous, myself and Peter and Manny were on the bench. DC was playing 10, we had Dennis Fogarty playing, Billy Holland, Archer, Ivan Dineen. I think they had like Danny Reardon, Simon Keogh, Leo Ova, Chris Keane, I think, was on the bench of them. He tore us asunder, like literally, we could not contain him. And what was that big tight head as well that went to Connacht in the end?
Stuart McGuire.
Yeah, he was there as well. He was like making outside breaks and everything. He was like, Jesus, what a day.
But there is, every time we played against Leo, he would inevitably put me on my ass at least once during that game. I remember there was one game in particular. I think there was an international game on. So they put back the kickoff to like 5:30 maybe on a Saturday. So it was on in Belvedere. And I remember like it was kind of getting dewy because it was in winter, you know. And I remember him catching a kick, of course, and me being first in the line to tackle him. I remember him just putting a knee on me and me, I'd say I skidded for 3 metres along on my ass on the wet ground. And there's a lot of young fellas have been on the piss for the day in the Belvedere crowd. Just said,
similar thing happened to me in that AIL final. So I came on about 5 minutes into the second half and they kicked off. We caught it and I said to Gerry Hurley, go on, box kick there and I'll chase it. Because I know I was defending 10 or whatever way it worked out anyway. So he box kicked it. He was under it, Leo, like, and I was like, right, I'm going to go from here, like. So I threw myself at him thinking I was going to bury him. He literally just breezed me off. Like it was a gust of wind just knocked me over. And then literally about 2 passes later, they scored in the corner. I was like, oh, what an introduction.
So, I'd love to know where he's playing now. Like, I mean, I don't think he was that old. I'm sure he's still playing somewhere at some level. One of those kind of standout names for me. Did you have a look at the France game?
I did, yeah.
They're impressive once again.
Yeah, delighted.
I actually saw a very interesting thing a few days ago about Boutier, the full back. He actually hasn't had a traditional route to international rugby at all.
Like Division 2 or something there.
Yeah, so he played with his local amateur club until he was 18. And then he was with Dax for a little while, but he was with Van and went between 3rd Division and 2nd Division with them for 5 years. And he only signed for Montpellier last year. That was his first year. Or sorry, as in last summer. This season is his first year in top 14. And yeah, he's gonna make another step up and is playing with the French national team now.
He was even better again last weekend, I thought.
He was. He seems to be growing into it. And France
was much more dangerous in attack this week. I thought he ran a few nice lines and had a few good involvements there. Was he involved in that Teddy Tamat try that was pulled back? Did he give the offload to Vakato, was it?
I can't remember.
I think he did, but he looked quite dangerous in attack, which I think was an improvement, well, not an improvement, but he hadn't looked so dangerous in attack the previous 2 weeks, so it was good to see.
Yeah, he kind of is one of many stories like that in France where you actually see a lot of those. I suppose they're kind of like Jamie Vardy stories where guys start at the bottom division and kind of climb their way up. Like, we'd never hear about it really in rugby here. But it happens quite a bit in France. So in my own case, for example, there was two guys, when we got promoted, there were two guys signed for the year we were going into top 14. One of them had been at Chambry, who were a 3rd division club for 10 years. And then he was actually at Van as well for 2 years, and he was playing top 14 the following year. Yeah. Another back row who's club captain this year, he played with Massey. He actually played with John Madigan and Massey. Oh, yeah. They won the 3rd division, and he played a year at 2nd division, and it literally went 3rd division, 2nd division, top 14 one year after another. And an excellent player as well, very comfortable at top 14. He caused lineouts, and just a really good, solid guy. And I really love seeing stories like that. And I mean, the two of them, Grenoble are 2nd division now at the moment, but both of them have signed on again for another 2 years. So it's great to see avenues like that. You don't really hear about it happening a whole pile in England either, but you do the odd time. But again, it just kind of ties into what we were talking about earlier, the level of opportunity that other guys have in other countries.
The French have got a good nucleus there now between Aldred, Dupont, Ficou.
He's an excellent player as well, but they're all very young. Or inexperienced.
They come in for what was the captain's name last year again? The hooker.
Garrado.
Yeah, Garrado. I nearly said Giroud, but he's a soccer player. Garrado, like, he's come in. There were some big boots to fill there, and I think he's had a great game or had a great tournament so far. Especially Camille Chef probably was the number one going into it, but I think did he get injured before the first round or at some point?
That'll be a good tit for tat, I think, going forward. They're both very young and both excellent players.
50 minutes with Marshawn, then seeing Cammy Shack on by. He must be dreading it. But from a Welsh point of view, I think they're struggling a bit there. I think Liam Williams is a big miss. Jonathan Davies also. Obviously France kicked a lot of long ball, and Halfpenny probably isn't as good at counter-attacking as Liam Williams would be.
Yeah.
So I think that is hindering him a small bit. Say Jonathan Davies, I think Tompkins has been struggling a bit in the centre.
You'd never dismiss a guy after three games, but
he's got
but he has had a slow start, but he's played excellently. His form has been excellent for the last few years, so hopefully he can rectify that.
They're actually missing a good few lads. Wales has only kind of dawned to me there. It was like in the back row, Navidi, Ellis Jenkins, Aaron Shingler, the three of those lads who had, I suppose, big impacts when they were playing over the last couple of years.
Particularly Navidi, who was...
him and Ellis Jenkins used to destroy us every time over in Cardiff as well. They used to play like Nick Williams and the two lads, so basically two sevens playing, and Nick Williams, they would have a field day getting turnovers against us.
Navidi's a pro surfer, you know, as well. Yeah, like, I'm sure he doesn't compete a whole pile, but he has like a certificate or a qualification to compete professionally in surfing. Yeah,
jeez, that's interesting.
I always assumed there was something kind of different about him because he had the dreads, obviously. But that's pretty cool. Being a pro surfer while playing pro rugby as well. Moving on from international stuff, Munster had a pretty good pedestrian win over the weekend, 28-0. I don't know. Did you see the red card that Zebra got? I mean, basically he got it for leading with the forearm into the neck.
Sorry,
while carrying
actually.
The ball. I thought it was very harsh.
Thought
it was very harsh. I mean, after 10 minutes.
They're clamping down on that now, so never getting away with it.
They are, but I mean, they even acknowledged when they were chatting about it that it starts in the chest and rides up to the neck. I mean, Chris Clude is 5'8". I mean, it's, and he's standing upright basically when he's tackling. That's the way he tackles. So I think it was unfair. I mean, I think a yellow card would have done then. And I mean, particularly in a game like that, it's a bit too ruthless for my liking.
But, I did see Kevin O'Byrne had a sensational out the back door.
He did, yeah. And it was a great front row combination there. So Jeremy Lachman, he caught it, stepped inside, stepped out of a tackle, one arm offload. Then it was OB to JJ in a ridiculous kind of quadruple skip pass, especially over the top to Swedes.
And Stu slammed his way in there then into the corner.
He did, yeah. But it's funny.
He texted me earlier, actually, giving out saying that we...
Calling him Stewart.
He's wondering why people are asking now, why is he called Stewie?
Why Stewie?
Why Stewart?
Jake Flannery got his first cap, a good Shannon man, so hopefully the first of many.
Haven't seen much of him, is he?
He's an excellent player, yeah.
He's very talented, right? Yeah.
He is, he's used to playing 15 a lot as well. He swapped between the two of them quite regularly for the Irish 20s.
Better position or preferred?
I'd like to see him play 10. He's really great at attacking the line. He's very creative.
I didn't see he wasn't involved in training last year because obviously he was injured, I think, after the 20s. So he wasn't training much with us. So I didn't see much of him now, but I've heard good things about him. Look forward to seeing him.
Be a big issue for Munster now, trying to keep those three lads happy going forward. Yeah. Ben Healy himself and Jack Crowley. A great problem to have, but it's going to take a lot of clever management.
Is there as well? He's maybe not an out and out 10, but he's kind of a fellow who could play everywhere. Maybe hindered his progression the fact that he seemed to be able to play 10, 12, 15.
Yeah,
he's a great player as well. Got great skills, and I mean, he used to be training with us. Like, and he'd never look out of place. If anything, he always looked like he was adding to the training session. So it. You know, it's kind of a hard time for him as well, I'd say, not getting much of a look in there.
An abundance of riches in a certain position, which is a great problem to have. I actually was reminded when I kind of was making my notes for today, and I noted that it was Jake Flannery's first cap, we forgot to say to Sherry that about his cap coming on for the States, kind of in the belief that he was going to start the game the following week and that he wasn't involved in the squad. It was so shitty. But a similar enough thing happened to me. I got brought in just after I'd moved down to Limerick from Dublin. I got brought in because they were having a nightmare at hooker at Irish 20. So I got brought in for the game against England. And I actually threw so badly that week that... I came on as prop for the last 15 minutes. So Alan Clark was the coach who recently parted company with Ospreys. But I remember
he was very, very supportive of you.
I remember him radioing down to whoever it was. I think it was Phil Morrow was our SNC, and radioing down going, "Do you want to come on at loosehead or a hooker?" And I was like, "Oh Jesus!" Like, just you that's not my decision to make. Like, you know. So he was like, "Okay, they're going to put you on loosehead." I was like, "Okay, fine." So anyway, I went on, had my 12 or 15 minutes. We had an excellent win, actually. Not too dissimilar to the one the lads had on Friday. And a big celebration afterwards, and was dropped out of the squad the following week. And I remember subsequently, remember Steve Abood from the RFU? He's kind of a guy that's had various positions in the RFU over the years, a kind of a stalwart of the place. But he used to come down and do workshops when we were in the academy the odd time. And there was one about, I think it was about goal setting or objectives.
Insights, was it?
No, it wasn't that. It was different to that. Okay. And I remember him saying, he started off the talks, about 25 people in the room. And he said, what's the only thing that's worse than getting no caps for Ireland? And I knew straight away what he was going to say, and I didn't want to say it. So... people were going suggesting X, Y, and Z, and I was like, I'm fairly, he's definitely going to say what I think he's going to say. And eventually at the end, the only thing worse than getting no caps for Ireland is getting one cap for Ireland, because it means they thought you were good enough, but you weren't.
How did you not remember that for sure?
Because in either game, life or rugby, the margin for error is so small. I mean, one half step too late or too early and you don't quite make it. One half second too slow or too fast and you don't quite catch it.
On the line now we have John Andrus, former colleague of ours and owner and operator of Rugby Management Rugby Agency. John, thanks for joining us.
Oh, John, I think it's fair to say you're probably not a household name in Irish rugby. Or correct me if I'm not, if I'm being a bit harsh there, but you had a fantastic playing career. Two stints at Exeter, at Harlequins, at Worcester, and ultimately at Edinburgh before you came down to Munster. And then you decided to call it quits at the end of that season in 2017, regardless. But ultimately, which is the main reason we wanted to chat to you, is that you decided to go to the dark side, as we said in our intro. And you decided to set up a sports agency. Can you tell us how you came to that decision?
Suppose when it was coming to the end, I was thinking of things, you know, how could I stay involved in rugby? In a way, to be honest, the coaching route, I mean, it's so competitive and it's such a political minefield and there's no stability in it, that it was just too risky with the wife and kids. And I've always felt that, you know, I like the side of watching people develop or helping them on their journey, and I think the agency was something I was really keen on. And I also felt, to be honest with you, Duncan, there was a lot that could be done for players that wasn't being done from an agent's perspective. And when we set it up, I set it up with my cousin, Roger Wilson, who had played years for Ulster and Northampton. And we both were on the similar line of thinking that we were going to be totally pro-player and looking after the player. And we felt that agents, a lot of them to that point, had been pro-club. And what I mean when I say that is, you had certain agencies with 30-odd players at one club, and it was just impossible to have the players' benefits at heart. And we felt that if we could have enough contacts at a lot of clubs, we wouldn't need to have players in the same positions at the same clubs, and we wouldn't be reliant on a massive sort of payday off that club either, meaning we couldn't afford to argue or fall out with them.
Yeah, makes sense. It's like, a good outlook to have, isn't it?
Yeah, like, I mean, it's it is a complete minefield for players. I think particularly younger players when they're starting out, because, like, say, by the time I signed my first professional contract, it was 2013, and rugby had been professional for quite a while at that point, but I, like, nobody was able to kind of pull me aside and say, look, you need to watch out for X, Y, and Z, or be mindful of this or that. And I mean, particularly in Ireland, because there are only four teams, but there are very few agents in the Irish market, so it means that I suppose your choice is limited, and then the level of competition is kind of limited between them as well. So it is kind of a minefield, and it is a bit of a grey area. So how have you found moving into that area of kind of being the guy that looks after players, as opposed to being the guy who's on the phone to the agent and kind of chasing clubs?
I mean, well, first of all, we deal with enough contacts around all the clubs anyway, personal relationships with directors of rugby we've maybe worked with before, guys we've played with that are now in coaching, and we build up those contacts, and we go to watch youngsters and, you know, see who we think's going to make it, or players that we maybe played with and think have that ability. And I think once you really back somebody, you know, it's easy to do a good job for them as well. Do you mean in terms of how do we set about being pro player rather than pro club?
Well, yeah, I suppose the reason we wanted to chat to you is that it's a very kind of enigmatic area. Not many people know what being an agent actually entails. So as someone who's just come into it recently and is starting out, really, can you give people an idea of kind of what your day-to-day stuff involves?
I mean, we're looking to do it slightly differently. So I've two shareholders in the company, a guy, Craig Holmes, who's with a company, H&H Group in Belfast. He's in commercial finance and different things, and then another guy, Alan Hunter, he's with Midas Insurance, an insurance company. And what we're trying to do for players now is help them away from rugby, take away those stressors, things like, you know, mortgage advice, you know, your car, house, career-ending insurance, you know, if they want to upskill themselves in terms of doing a career after, or link them with companies by doing potential work in between, you know, off time. So we're looking to take away a lot of the stressors they have that might affect, you know, their ability to focus just on rugby. Because a happy player makes a better player. And then, like I say, we're looking to have players at a whole range of different clubs. So we have the ability, you know, to move players. And also, we're not going to take on two players in the same position at the same club, because you just can't represent them properly then. Mm,
yeah, absolutely.
That's a great, yeah.
That happens far more than people think.
Yeah, way too regularly. It's you sell a good package there, John. Have you got space for an elderly nine, by any chance?
Well, I'd have a hard time selling
them.
Nah, what are you doing? I'd wind back the clock and get them in somewhere easy.
But it's
interesting. We've Rory Sullivan there, the Scotland loose heads with us. And when we took him on there, he was third choice loose head at Edinburgh. And I'm not saying we made the extra difference to make him the Scottish loose head at the minute, but I do think those little bits of advice that you can be giving players, or speaking to them all the time. And, you know, when you're stuck in that bubble of being a professional rugby player, as you know yourself, you can get in an emotional turmoil and make decisions in a bad state of mind. Whereas if you're someone to speak to that's on the outside of it and has experienced it before and can give sound advice, it can help a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And to have someone who's previously played at a high level definitely makes you far more relatable. And I think you have a much better understanding of what is going through a player's head at certain stages, be it positive things or negative things. Like, if everything is going very well for someone, they can completely neglect stuff outside of their immediate focus, which is rugby and being the best they can be on the pitch. And similarly, if things are going very badly for someone, it can be quite a dark place, as you know yourself. I know, like, your agent Niall Woods, don't obviously play that, like, he played a high level rugby himself, so he would have had that perspective too. But there are a lot of people, it's not kind of, it's one of those things, there's no clear pathway to from being a player to being an agent. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that many people consider. So I think it is great that you and Roger as well would have both had a huge amount of experience of professional rugby.
Niall was in a good position because he was obviously in charge of Rugby Players or IRUPA at the time, which is now Rugby Players Ireland. So he was in charge of running that from a legal point of view. So that's how he kind of identified that there were, obviously, it was getting bigger and the demand for agents was getting greater. So he kind of saw an opening there, and that's how he kind of got into it.
John, moving on from kind of the ins and outs of agency and talking about Irish players specifically, we've chatted a few times already about how it's very difficult to penetrate certain markets as an Irish player because you only have four teams here. And fair enough, if you're a guy in Leinster and you don't quite cut the mustard up there, you'd probably pick up a contract in another province. But if you're surplus to requirements in one of the other three provinces, there's very limited opportunity for you. And last week we were talking about the issue of funding to the championship being cut and how that's going to affect a huge amount of players and how that might close off a pathway for Irish players that would have been well trodden at one point. So how do you see the opportunities for Irish players at the moment? I know the US League has opened up doors to certain people, but it is quite difficult to be a young Irish guy and to be looking around for a club, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's phenomenally difficult. And like you say, there's a lot of talent in Ireland. And unfortunately, there's limited positions. And like you know yourself, Duncan, often it's only one man's opinion that's stopping you from progressing, and a lot of guys, you know, might give up at that. But it's silly, because if there is another avenue and you have the ability, you're best taking it, because there's not many success stories. I do think that with the championship funding being cut, I think they've now decided to stall it, do it gradually over 2 years. But I think in the long term, it'll just be interesting to see what avenue they take, whether Premiership squads are going to expand and have and larger squads with a second tier competition. Is that like they do in South Africa where you've got like a Curry Cup squad and a Super Rugby squad? Mm. Maybe they go down the Premiership route with a Premiership Cup. But I don't know what pathway they're looking at to develop their players. Certainly for Irish players, we're going to have to explore other avenues for guys that aren't going to make it on these shores.
You've placed a couple of guys down in New Zealand recently, haven't you?
Well, no, we're talking to... There's a guy that's a young second row that's leaving our Ulster that's potentially going over to Otago. Yeah, it looks like he is. And obviously, Gavin Thornbury, the second row of Connacht, went that route, and it did him no harm. So there's potentially other avenues with it's the other side of the world, so it's a big decision to make.
I think it's a great opportunity, though. I know, in my head, I would have always seen myself as probably not being good enough to go down to New Zealand and give things a go down there. But you do see certain guys going down there and making a go of it. Obviously, Ollie Yeager is playing regularly enough for the Crusaders now, who is from England originally but went to Blackrock College. Even a guy who came in briefly to Munster a few years back, Jamie Glynn, who his brother would be famous for... spear tackling Chris Ashton in Burger King after once they played North London a few years ago. Do you not know that story? That's famous in rugby circles.
I think it was
on the rugby pod. He rang in, he interviewed them and all. They interviewed him and all because they spoke about it, about the incident, and then he rang in the following week and they had a full on kind of recounting of the tale there. But Jamie Glynn, who was in on trial at Munster, he lined out for the Melbourne Rebels a couple of times in pre-season. So I think people underestimate the quality of training that Irish players get, even at academy level in the provinces and even at club level. So hopefully it's a path that more players can avail of down the line.
Yeah, it's great to see guys, that do have the courage to go away and pursue something, come out the other end of it at the end too, because it does take a lot of balls to put yourself in different environments and, at a young age as well. So it's good to see it pay off sometimes in the long run. And like you say, there's so limited opportunities at the provinces.
John, that's been a fascinating chat. Thanks very much for your time. And
very enlightening. And glad that it sounds like you're doing the right by the players anyway.
Yeah, there's clearly one good skin in the agency game at least. Yeah. So. Dunk, pleasure as always.
Yeah, great to see you again.
And look forward to catching up again next week. Take care.